That was our pastime. That was Friday night. In later life, Clark would become Reverend Clark. Whether out of professional pique or some instinctive fear, the ship's mascot, a cat named Dowie, after Captain Turner's predecessor, fled the ship that night, for points unknown. Captain Turner also left the ship that evening. He made his way to Broadway, to the Harris Theater on 42nd Street, and there caught a play, The Lie, in which his niece, a rising actress named Mercedes Desmore, had a starring role. Turner also indulged his passion for German food. He went to Luchau's at 110 East 14th Street, an easy walk from the Cunard docks, and dined in its Nibelungen room, where an 8-piece orchestra played a brisk accompaniment of Viennese waltzes. That evening, back at his sister's apartment, Charles Laureate showed her and her husband the Dickens book and the Thackeray drawings, and explained why he was bringing the drawings to England. When he bought them in 1914 from Thackeray's daughter and granddaughter, Lady Ritchie and Hester Ritchie of London, he paid a bargain price of $4,500, fully aware that he could sell them in America for 5 or 6 times as much. To get the best price, however, he had come to realize that he would need to present the drawings in a more appealing manner. At the moment, they were pasted into the 2 scrapbooks, 1 drawing per page. He planned to have most of the drawings mounted individually and framed, but some he wanted to bind in combinations of 3 or 4, in books with full Levant bindings. His main reason for bringing them back to England was so that Lady Ritchie could see them one more time and write a small note about each, thereby providing authentication and an extra element of interest. He felt no guilt about paying Lady Ritchie so little for the drawings. That was the way the art business worked, especially if a seller wanted discretion, as the Ritchies did. They insisted that he keep the sale of the drawings as quiet as possible and barred him from attempting to sell them in Britain. He could offer them only in America, and even then he had to do so quietly, without advertising. Lady Ritchie was still smarting from the unexpected sequelae of a previous sale of drawings through a London dealer who had marketed them in a manner that the family found offensive and that had drawn unpleasant publicity and comment. Laureate's sister and her husband inspected the drawings with a great deal of interest and admiration, Laureate recalled. The husband, George, confessed to liking in particular a drawing entitled The Caricature of Thackeray Himself Stretched Out on a Sofa in the Old Garrick Club, and a series of 6 sketches of Negroes and their children on the porch of a small house, which Thackeray had drawn while visiting the American South in the 1850s. Afterward, Laureate packed the book and drawings back into his extension suitcase and locked it. Elsewhere in the city, a scheduled passenger named Alta Piper struggled through a restless night in her hotel room. She was the daughter of Leonora Piper, the famed spirit medium known universally as Mrs. Piper, the only medium that William James, the pioneering Harvard psychologist and sometime psychic investigator, believed to be authentic. Alta seemed to share her mother's gift, for throughout that Friday night, as she claimed later, she heard a voice telling her, "If you get into your berth, you'll never get out." Room 40. The Mystery. The departure of Walter Schwieger's U-20 was watched closely, from afar. In London, 2 blocks from the Thames and adjacent to the parade ground of the Horse Guards, stood a 5-story building with a facade of pale stone and whiskey-colored brick. Familiar to everyone in the Admiralty, the structure was known, for short, as the Old Building, or, for shorter, OB. Far less familiar was a secret operation located along one of its corridors in a group of offices centered on Room 40. Here resided the mystery, or the Holy of Holies, its function manifest only to its staff and to a coven of 9 senior officials, including First Lord Churchill and Admiral Jackie Fisher, who by April 1915 had re-entered the Admiralty as First Sea Lord, Churchill's number 2. Fisher was 74 years old, 3 decades older than his chief. Every day, the watchkeepers in Room 40 received hundreds of coded and enciphered German messages that had been intercepted by an array of wireless stations erected on the British coast, and then sent to the old building by land telegraph. Germany had been forced to rely almost exclusively on wireless communication after Britain, in the first days of the war, had followed through on its 1912 plan to cut Germany's undersea cables. The intercepted messages arrived in the basement of the Admiralty building and were then relayed to Room 40. It was the task of Room 40 to translate these messages into the King's English, a process made possible by a series of nearly miraculous events that occurred in the closing months of 1914 and put the Admiralty in possession of 3 codebooks governing German naval and diplomatic communications. By far the most important and secret was the German Navy's SKM code, short for Signalbuch der Kaiserlichen Marine. In August 1914, a German destroyer, the Magdeburg, ran aground and was cornered by Russian ships. Exactly what happened next remains unclear, but one story holds that the Russians found a copy of the codebook still clutched in the arms of a dead German signalman whose body had washed ashore after the attack. If so, it was probably the codebook that killed him. It was large and heavy, 15 inches by 12 inches by 6 inches, and contained 34,304 3-letter groups used to encode messages. The letters MUD, for example, stood for Nantucket. Liverpool was FCJ. The Russians, in fact, recovered 3 copies of the codebook, presumably not from the same body, and in October 1914, gave one to the Admiralty. The codebooks were invaluable, but did not by themselves reveal the contents of the intercepted messages. Their German authors used the volumes to obscure the original plain text messages, but then subjected the encoded versions to a further scrambling through the use of a cipher. Only holders of a cipher key could divine the underlying text, but possessing the codebooks made the whole process of solving the messages far simpler. To exploit these treasures, the Admiralty established Room 40. In a handwritten directive, Churchill set out its primary mission, to penetrate the German mind, or as one of the group's key officers put it, to extract the juice. From the start, Churchill and Fisher resolved to keep the operation so secret that only they and a few other Admiralty officials would ever know it existed. Equally mysterious, though unintentionally so, was the matter of who actually managed the group. On paper, at least, it reported to Admiral Henry Francis Oliver, the Admiralty's chief of staff, a man so tight-lipped and reticent he could seem almost mute, and this, given the British Navy's predilection for nicknames, ensured that he would be known forever as Dummy Oliver. Within Room 40 itself, however, management of day-to-day operations fell largely, if informally, to Commander Herbert Hope, recruited in November 1914 to bring naval expertise to the interpretation of intercepted messages. His savvy was badly needed, for the group's staff were not Navy officers, but civilians recruited for their skill at mathematics and German, and whatever else it was that made a man good at breaking codes and ciphers. The roster came to include a pianist, a furniture expert, a parson from Northern Ireland, a wealthy London financier, a past member of the Scottish Olympic hockey team, and a dapper operative named C. Summers Cox, who, according to one early member, William F. Clark, was chiefly remarkable for his spats. The unit's women, known as the Fair Ladies in 40, served in clerical roles and included one Lady Hambro, wife of a prominent financier, who, according to Clark, startled everyone at one of the group's annual dinners by smoking a large cigar. Wrote Clark, "It was the best of jobs, and we were a happy band in those days with the best possible of chiefs in the person of Hope." Hope was modest and retiring, and a skilled manager, Clark recalled, and all of us became deeply attached to him. Hope's authority was recognized outside Room 40 as well, much to the displeasure of Dummy Oliver, who was said to be obsessed with controlling who saw the deciphered intercepts and what was done with the information they revealed. When First Sea Lord Fisher made his initial visit to Room 40 and saw firsthand what the group was doing, he ordered Hope to bring him the latest intercepts in person twice a day. Hope also provided intercepts directly to another official who, of all those privy to the mystery, had perhaps the greatest appreciation for the value of its secrets, Captain William Reginald Hall, Director of Naval Intelligence. It was Hall who had recommended that Commander Hope, then a member of his intelligence division, should be transferred to Room 40. Despite being Chief of Naval Intelligence, Captain Hall had no direct control over Room 40. As of early 1915, his intelligence division and Room 40 were separate entities, but his name, more than any other, would come to be associated with its achievements. Hall was 44 years old and a former warship captain. He became Director of Naval Intelligence in November 1914, filling a post once held by his father. He was short and brisk, with a face full of points and angles and a prominent bill-like nose, all of which gave him the look of a woodpecker in a captain's cap. This was reinforced by a neurological quirk that caused him to blink rapidly all day long, and that earned him his own naval nickname, Blinker. One of his most ardent admirers was America's Ambassador Page in London, who, in a letter to President Wilson, heaped praise like a man in love. "I shall never meet another man like him," Page wrote. "That were too much to expect. For Hall can look through you and see the very muscular movements of your immortal soul while he is talking to you. Such eyes the man has, my lord." Hall delighted in the gamesmanship of war and was said to be utterly ruthless, albeit in an engaging way. His secretary, Ruth Skrine, later to marry and bear the wedded name Mrs. Hotblack, recalled how one acquaintance had described Hall as being part Machiavelli, part schoolboy. "The Machiavelli side could be cruel," she said, "but the schoolboy was always round the corner, and his love of the dangerous game he and all of us were playing would bubble out, and the fun and hazard of it all would fill him with infectious delight. He was," she said, "uncannily quick at sizing up a man." When contemplating some new escapade, she recalled, Hall would rub his hands together, grinning like a crafty little French abbé. It was a vital game, in which Room 40 gave Britain an edge of inestimable value at a time when the war, far from concluding quickly, was expanding everywhere, with Germany ascendant. Battles raged in Russia, Austria, Serbia, Turkey, and Asia. In the South China Sea, a German torpedo boat sank a Japanese cruiser, killing 271 men. In the Pacific, off Chile, German warships sank two British cruisers, drowning 1,600 men and delivering a blow to Britain's pride and morale, the Empire's first defeat in a naval battle since the War of 1812, when a British naval force on Lake Champlain had been defeated by the fledgling U.S. Navy. On New Year's Day, 1915, a German submarine sank the British battleship HMS Formidable for a loss of 547 men. British warships nearby were forbidden to rescue survivors, in accord with the policy set up after the Aboukir disaster. The war had grown darker, and had sired new tactics for killing. German warships shelled the English coastal towns of Scarborough, Whitby, and Hartlepool, injuring over 500 people and killing more than 100, most of them civilians. The dead in Scarborough included 2 9-year-old boys and a 14-month-old baby. On January 19, 1915, Germany launched its first-ever air raid against Britain, sending 2 giant Zeppelins across the Channel. Zepps, in newly coined British slang, progeny of Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin. The raid caused minimal damage, but killed 4 civilians. Another raid followed on January 31st, during which 9 airships flew as far as Liverpool, along the way sending terrifying shadows scudding across the landscape of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. And then came April 22, 1915. Late afternoon, near Ypres. Bright sunshine, a light breeze blowing from east to west. The Allied trenches in this sector, or salient, were occupied by Canadian and French forces, including a division of Algerian soldiers. The opposing Germans launched an offensive, which as usual began with shelling by distant artillery. This was terrifying enough, and the French and Canadians knew by experience it was a prelude to a head-on infantry attack across no man's land. But at about 5 p.m., the look of the battlefield abruptly changed. A gray-green cloud rose from the German side and began drifting across the blasted terrain as German soldiers opened the valves on 6,000 tanks filled with over 160 tons of chlorine gas, arrayed along a 4-mile stretch of the front, the first-ever use of lethal gas on a battlefield. As the gas reached the Allied side, its effects were immediate and terrible. Hundreds died at once. Thousands ran from their trenches in a panic, many having experienced exposure that would kill them later. Their flight opened an 8,000-yard hole in the Allied line, but the effect of the gas attack seemed to surprise even its architects. German soldiers wearing respirators followed the gas cloud, but instead of surging through the newly opened gap for a decisive victory, dug a new trench line and stayed put. Their commanders, intending mainly to test the gas, had not assembled the necessary reserve forces to take advantage of the opening in the line. 2,000 Canadian soldiers were killed, suffocated as fluid filled their lungs. Wrote one general, "I saw some 100 poor fellows laid out in the open, in the forecourt of a church, to give them all the air they could get, slowly drowning with water in their lungs. A most horrible sight, and the doctors quite powerless." But these cataclysms played out on land. Where Room 40 promised to give Britain the clearest advantage was in the battle for control of the seas. And there Britain's strategy had undergone a change. Its centerpiece remained the destruction of Germany's fleet in battle, but the Admiralty gave new weight to interrupting the flow of war materiel to Germany and to combating the growing U-boat threat to British commerce. The Admiralty also harbored the persistent fear that Germany might attempt a full-scale invasion of Britain. Clearly, any advance warning of German naval actions would be of critical importance. Room 40 began providing such intelligence almost at once. From November 1914 until the end of the war, according to the group's William Clark, no major movement of the German fleet could take place without the Admiralty knowing about it sometime in advance. The information was detailed, right down to the movements of individual ships and submarines. But such detail raised a quandary. If the British Navy acted in response to every foretold movement of the German fleet, it risked revealing to Germany that its codes had been broken. In a secret internal memorandum, Admiral Oliver wrote that the risk of compromising the codes ought only to be taken when the result would be worth it. But what did worth it mean? Some of the men within Room 40 contended that much useful information was stockpiled and never used because the Admiralty staff, meaning dummy Oliver, had an obsessive fear of revealing the mystery. For the first 2 years of the war, even the commander-in-chief of the British fleet, Sir John Jellicoe, was denied direct access to Room 40's decrypted intercepts, although he would seem to have been the one officer in the fleet most likely to benefit from the intelligence they conveyed. In fact, Jellicoe would not be formally introduced to the secret of Room 40, let alone given regular access to its intelligence, until November 1916, when the Admiralty, sensing bruised feelings, agreed to let him see a daily summary, which he was to burn after reading. The tight control over intercepts exercised by Chief of Staff Oliver was also a source of irritation for Room 40's Commander Hope. "Had we been called upon by the staff to do so," Hope wrote, referring to Oliver, "we could have furnished valuable information as to movements of submarines, minefields, mine sweeping, etc. But the staff was obsessed with the idea of secrecy. They realized that they held the trump card, and they worked on the principle that every effort must be made to keep our knowledge to ourselves, so as to be able to keep it up our sleeves for a really great occasion, such as the German fleet coming out in all their strength to throw down the gauge in battle. In other words, the staff determined to make use of our information defensively, and not offensively." It was tedious work. Hundreds of intercepted messages came chattering into the building's basement every day, where they were placed in dumbbell-shaped canisters, which in turn were shoved into vacuum tubes and, with a satisfying whump, launched up through the building. Upon reaching Room 40, the containers tumbled into a metal tray with a clatter that shook the nerve of any unwitting visitor, according to one of the group's codebreakers. The noise of these arriving messages was especially hard on the men assigned to the night watch, who took turns sleeping in a bedroom that connected two larger offices. They endured an additional hardship: mice. The rodents infested the bedroom, and late at night trotted over the faces of the sleeping men. Tubists took the messages from the vacuum canisters and passed them on to the codebreakers. The tubists were officers who had been injured badly enough in the war that they could no longer fight. This cadre included a one-legged man named Haggard and a one-eyed British officer named Edward Molyneux, who would go on to become an acclaimed designer of clothing in Paris. The most tedious part of the job was writing the complete text of each message into a daily log. Churchill insisted that every intercept be recorded, no matter how routine. As the number of intercepts multiplied, this task became soul-destroying, according to one Room 40 member. The log became an object of hatred. But Churchill paid close attention. In March 1915, for example, he scrawled on one of Hope's decrypts, "Watch this carefully." The group learned over time that even a seemingly innocuous change in the character of routine messages could signal an important new action by the German Navy. Wrote Commander Hope, "Any messages which were not according to routine were to be looked on with great suspicion, and in this way we were able to build up a large number of signs and portents." The British wireless operators who listened in on German communications came to know just by the sound of a transmission whether it came from a submarine. They found that U-boats first took a few moments to tune their systems, and then began each transmission with a kind of electrical throat clearing. 5 Morse signals. Dash, dash, dot, dash, dash. The final note, Commander Hope said, is high-pitched and has a wailing or whining character when sending. Thanks to captured charts, Room 40 also knew that the German Navy had divided the seas around England into a grid to better direct the travels of surface ships and submarines. The North Sea had been broken into squares 6 miles on a side, with each square assigned a number, according to Hope. Whenever any of their vessels was at sea, she was continually signaling her position by saying what square she was in. By plotting these on a chart, Hope wrote, Room 40 learned which routes German ships and U-boats followed. Some squares were consistently empty. It was only reasonable to suppose that these blank spaces were mined areas. Over time, thanks to Room 40's intercepts and information gleaned from interrogations of captured submariners, both Room 40 and Captain Blinker Hall's intelligence division developed a sense of the flesh-and-blood men who commanded Germany's U-boats. A few, like Kapitänleutnant Wettigen, the man who sank the cruisers Abukir, Cressy, and Hoag, were daring and pushed their crews to the limit. A captain of this kind was called a Draufganger, or dashing commander. Another commander, Klaus Rucker, was said to be a bully and a coward. In contrast, Walter Schwieger was described in several intelligence reports as a good-natured soul who was well-liked by his crew and peers, a very popular and pleasant officer, as one report put it. Some U-boat captains were cold-blooded killers, like Schwieger's friend Max Valentiner. He is said to be the most powerfully built officer in the German Navy, a British interrogator reported, and one of the most ruthless submarine commanders. But another captain, Robert Morat, saved lives whenever possible. After his boat was sunk and he and 4 members of his crew were captured, interrogators learned through him and the others that the life of a U-boat commander was not all discomfort. Morat woke each day at 10 a.m. and climbed to the deck for a short stroll. He ate lunch by himself and afterward read in his cabin, always keeping a stock of good books on board. At 4 o'clock he had tea, and at 7 o'clock supper, after which he remained in the wardroom, talking, playing games, or listening to the gramophone. He went to bed at 11 p.m. He made a habit of drinking a glass of wine just before turning in. Room 40 and Hall's division also gained insight into the finer points of U-boat culture. They learned, for example, that U-boat commanders did not care about the number of ships they sank, but rather their tonnage, because tonnage was what their superiors looked to when deciding to award honors. They learned, too, that the German Navy had its own tradition of assigning nicknames. One very tall commander was nicknamed Seesteifel, or Sea Boot. Another had a reputation for smelling bad and thus was nicknamed Hein Schniefelig, or Stinky Person. A third was said to be very childish and good-natured and was commonly called Das Kind, the child. The U-boat commanders had one thing in common, however. When it came to wireless, all were talkative, as Room 40 and Blinker Hall were delighted to learn. They used their wireless systems incessantly. In the course of the war, Room 40 would receive 20,000 intercepted messages that had been sent by U-boats. This extreme garrulity, as Room 40's Clark put it, allowed the group to keep close watch over U-boat travels, all duly recorded in a ledger kept by Commander Hope. In January 1915, Room 40 was able to pinpoint the first time a U-boat traveled as far as the Irish Sea, the body of water that separates England and Ireland. The group even identified the particular zone to which the U-boat's captain had been ordered, a square of sea near Liverpool. On that occasion, the value of the intelligence was immediately apparent, and the Admiralty acted at once. It sent a warning to the home fleet, identifying the source of its information only as a reliable authority. Destroyers converged on the U-boat's patrol zone from north and south. Two large Cunard liners, the Ausonia and Transylvania, were en route to Liverpool at the time, carrying naval gun barrels made by Bethlehem Steel. The Transylvania, then under the command of Captain Turner, also carried passengers, among them 49 Americans. The Admiralty ordered both ships to change course immediately and speed as fast as possible to Queenstown on the south coast of Ireland and wait there until destroyers could arrive to escort them to Liverpool. Upon arriving safely, Turner expressed his relief at having evaded attack. "I fooled them that time," he said. Room 40 had long followed Capitan Leutnant Walter Schwieger's U-20 and kept a running record of his patrols. When he left, which route he took, where he was headed, and what he was supposed to do once he got there. In early March 1915, Commander Hope monitored a voyage Schwieger made to the Irish Sea that coincided with a disturbing message broadcast from a German naval transmitter located at Nordach, on Germany's North Sea coast just below Holland. Addressed to all German warships and submarines, the message made specific reference to the Lusitania, announcing that the ship was en route to Liverpool and would arrive on March 4th or 5th. The meaning was obvious. The German Navy considered the Lusitania fair game. The Admiralty found the message disconcerting enough that it dispatched two destroyers to rendezvous with the ship and escort it to port. One destroyer sent an uncoded message asking the ship's then-captain, Daniel Dow, to report his position in order to arrange the meeting. Dow refused to give it, fearing that a U-boat had sent the message. The rendezvous never came off, but Dow succeeded in reaching Liverpool on his own. It was soon after this that he asked to be relieved, and Captain Turner took his place. As that spring of 1915 advanced, the code solvers in Room 40 honed their skills, delighted and a bit astonished by the fact that the German Navy still did not revise its code books. The mystery remained secure and continued to yield revelations about the travels of German U-boats. Toward the end of April, as Captain Turner readied the Lusitania for its May 1st departure, Room 40 learned of a new surge of U-boat activity. Intercepts showed that on Friday, April 30th, four U-boats left their bases. In response, War Staff Chief Dummy Oliver sent an urgent, ultra-secret message to Jellicoe at Scapa Flow. "Four submarines sailed yesterday from Heligoland," the message read. It identified their expected destinations. "They appear to be making good 12.5 knots. Do not divulge exact source of information in any steps you take." Within hours, Room 40 got word that two more U-boats also had departed, these from a base at Emden on Germany's North Sea coast. One of these was Schwieger's U-20. Considering that the German Navy typically had only an average of two U-boats in the North Sea or the Atlantic at any one time, this was an extraordinary development. Room 40's codebreakers found it a simple matter to follow U-20 through the first day or so of its voyage. Schwieger's wireless man repeated the boat's position 14 times in 24 hours. Room 40 did not have to look far to find the reason for this new and dangerous assault by Germany's U-boats. As it happened, it was the German Navy's response to a ruse concocted by Intelligence Chief Blinker Hall himself in the application of what he described as one of the first principles of the profession, that of mystifying and misleading the enemy. Lusitania, a cavalcade of passengers. By Saturday, May 1st, the heat wave had dissipated. The morning was cold, the sky pewter. The temperature made it easier for passengers arriving at Cunard's Pier 54 to transport their belongings, for now they could simply wear their heavy coats rather than bearing them draped over their arms along with all the other things they carried, their canes, umbrellas, valises, parcels, books, and babies, all in evidence on the sidewalk outside the terminal as a long black line of taximeter cabs emerged from 11th Avenue and pulled close to the curb. Large bags traveled on the floor beside the drivers and were hauled from the cabs by squat, strong-looking men in open jackets and bully caps. All these things were captured on film by a motion picture camera stationed just outside the entrance to the terminal. Passengers crossed its plane of view, men in topcoats, fedoras, and snap-brim caps, women with large hats mounded with sewn-on flowers, toddlers bundled as if for the Arctic, one with a knit cap pulled low over the ears. Now and then a face appeared in startling close-up, with that look travelers have always had over time, stern, concentrating, trying to pay the cabbie, hold the cane and gloves, the empty glove fingers flexing like a cow's udder, and still keep track of the suitcase and trunk receding into the Cunard terminal. At the far side of the building, the Lusitania's hull rose high above the wharf in a black wall of steel and rivets. The ship seemed as indestructible as anything that could be imagined, even for an age that imagined well and placed so much trust in immensity and invention. The furnaces in its boiler rooms flared as firemen raised steam for departure, its funnels exhausted braids of gray smoke into the mist above. As always, there were passengers who had achieved fame, and their arrival created a stir among the thousands of well-wishers, kin, and spectators now gathered along the wharf to see the ship off. Cunard had built grandstands to honor the custom, and these were full as always. They afforded a view not just of the ship, but of a portion of lower Manhattan and the wharves and vessels jutting from the shore on both sides of the Hudson. Just north stood the piers of the White Star Line, which 3 years earlier, almost to the month, were to have received the Titanic. Among the spectators, the attention given to the Lusitania and its passengers was more acute than usual, given the German warning published in the city's papers that morning. Here came Charles Frohman, the theater impresario who had made Ethel Barrymore a star and had brought the play Peter Pan to America, for which he dressed Maud Adams in a woodsy tunic with a broad collar, and in so doing forever engraved a particular image of the boy in the world's imagination. Frohman also produced the stage show Sherlock Holmes, with William Gillette as its namesake hero, with deerstalker cap and meerschaum pipe. Frohman, wearing a blue double-breasted suit, walked with a marked limp and used a cane. A friend of his also came aboard, Marguerite Lucille Jolivet, 25 years old, known universally by her stage and film name, Rita Jolivet. Though she had already performed in Shakespearean plays in London, including a turn as Juliet, and had appeared in several silent films made in Italy, she was still only a fledgling star. But Frohman liked her, and his interest virtually assured her a vibrant career. She was traveling now to Europe to act in several more Italian films. Another arrival was George Kessler, a wealthy wine importer known the world over as the Champagne King. Bearded and spectacled, evoking a certain Viennese psychoanalyst, he was known for throwing elaborate parties, known as freak dinners, perhaps most notably the gondola party he hosted in 1905 at the Savoy Hotel in London, where he filled the hotel's courtyard with water, dressed everyone in Venetian garb, and served dinner to guests aboard a giant gondola. Lest this be deemed insufficient, he arranged to have a birthday cake, 5 feet tall, brought in on the back of a baby elephant. By far the most glamorous passenger was Alfred Gwynne Vanderbilt I, son and primary heir of the late Cornelius, whose death in 1899 had left Alfred a rich man. Something of a rake, Alfred was tall and lean, with dark eyes and hair, and a taste for expensive suits. He was a welcome presence on board, especially among the women, despite the fact that he was married and carried with him a history of scandal. His first wife, Ellen French, had divorced him in 1908, charging him, as the New York Times put it, with misconducting himself with an unknown woman in his private rail car. The woman turned out to be Mary Ruiz, wife of a Cuban diplomat. The scandal drove Ruiz to commit suicide. Vanderbilt remarried, this time wedding Margaret Emerson, heiress to a trove of money that owed its existence to America's awful diet and its gastric consequences, the Bromo-Seltzer fortune. She was not on board. Vanderbilt was also a member of what a Minnesota newspaper called the Just Missed It Club, a fortunate group whose roster included Theodore Dreiser, Guglielmo Marconi, and J.P. Morgan, all of whom had planned to sail on the Titanic, but for one reason or another had changed their minds. Needless to say, Vanderbilt traveled in style, booking one of the Lusitania's parlor suites. He lodged his valet two doors down the corridor in an interior room with neither porthole nor bath. Vanderbilt paid for both tickets in cash, $1,001.50, equivalent to over $22,000 in today's dollars. Reporters came aboard, as usual, looking to interview famous or notorious passengers. Only today their interest was more focused than usual. It was a mark of the importance of shipping and the frequency with which transatlantic liners called at New York that every newspaper had a ship news reporter. Each paper devoted a page to the arrivals and departures of the great liners and to advertisements and schedules for the many shipping lines with piers in the city. It was on these pages that the German warning had appeared in a number of Saturday morning editions. The ship news reporters worked out of a shed-like structure near Battery Park in Lower Manhattan, adjacent to the terminal for the Staten Island Ferry, where a battered green door gave way to a room full of worn desks and telephones used by reporters for a dozen newspapers and one wire service. The reporters tended to favor certain ships, often for intangible reasons. "Ships do have personalities," wrote Jack Lawrence, the shipping writer for the New York Evening Mail. "Some ships have character and a warm, friendly atmosphere, while others are only steel plates riveted around throbbing turbines." One of the favorites was always the Lusitania. The ship invariably provided news, because as the fastest and most luxurious ocean liner still in service, it tended to draw the richest, most prominent passengers. Part of the ship's appeal was also due to the fact that its longtime chief purser, James McCubbin, 62, welcomed the reporters' attention and directed them to passengers likely to be of interest. As purser, McCubbin had the responsibility to make sure all passengers were tucked into their cabins and berths as quickly as possible, to store their valuables and, no small thing, to compile their bar bills at the end of the voyage. In the words of the Cunard Officer's Manual, he was to give satisfaction to all classes of passengers. The reporters met the Lusitania just before its departures, but also upon arrival when they would sail out to the quarantine station in New York Harbor. A ritual followed. They gathered in McCubbin's cabin. He would order a cabin boy to bring some ice, club soda, and a couple of bottles of Cunard Line scotch. He shut the door and handed out passenger lists. The last such session had taken place the previous week, when the Lusitania arrived from Liverpool and had brought the reporters some unwelcome news. McCubbin announced that his next voyage, the return to Liverpool departing Saturday, May 1st, would be his last crossing. Company rules required that he retire. I'm about to become the most useless mortal on Earth, he told the reporters. The sailor home from the sea. He called it a joke. Sailors don't have homes, he said, and added, when a sailor gets so old he can't work anymore, they ought to sew him up in a staysail rag and heave him over the side. On Saturday morning, reporter Jack Lawrence went aboard as usual, but now with a particular story in mind. He carried with him a copy of the German embassy's warning. Lawrence stopped by the cabin of Alfred Vanderbilt and knocked on the door. Vanderbilt himself opened it, wearing an elegant suit with a pink carnation in one lapel. In the room beyond, his valet was hard at work unpacking a small mountain of baggage. Lawrence had tried to interview Vanderbilt in the past and had typically found it a pointless exercise, because the man rarely had much to say. Alfred Vanderbilt may have been a riot among the ladies, Lawrence wrote, but in the presence of newspaper men, he was a shy and shrinking violet. Vanderbilt commented that there seemed to be an unusual amount of excitement aboard. Lots of talk about submarines, torpedoes, and sudden death, Vanderbilt said. I don't take much stock in it myself. What would they gain by sinking the Lusitania? He showed Lawrence a telegram he had received after boarding. The Lusitania is doomed, it read. Do not sail on her. It was signed Mort. Vanderbilt said he didn't know anyone named Mort, but wondered if it might have been an allusion to death. Probably somebody trying to have a little fun at my expense. Out on deck, Lawrence came across Elbert Hubbard, at this point one of the most famous men in America, the soap salesman turned author who had founded a collective in East Aurora, New York, called the Roycrofters, where men and women built furniture, bound books, made prints, and produced finely crafted goods of leather and metal. As an author, he was best known for his inspirational book, A Message to Garcia, about the value of personal initiative, and for an account of the Titanic disaster that centered on one woman's refusal to enter a lifeboat without her husband. He was headed now to Europe with the goal of interviewing Kaiser Wilhelm. Hubbard was famous as well for coining crisp aphorisms, including, a friend is someone who knows all about you and still loves you. He wore a Stetson hat and a flamboyant black cravat, more like a large gift ribbon, and had long flowing hair. When Lawrence approached him, Hubbard was standing beside his wife and eating a large red apple. Hubbard hadn't seen the warning. When I showed it to him, he merely glanced at it and went right on chewing his apple, Lawrence wrote. Hubbard took another apple out of his pocket and gave it to Lawrence. Here, have an apple, and don't bother your head about those Potsdam maniacs. They're all crazy. Lawrence pressed him. What if the German Navy really was planning an attack? What'll I do? Hubbard said. Why, I'll stay on the ship. I'm too old to go chasing after lifeboats, and I never was much of a hand at swimming. No, we'll stay by the ship. He turned to his wife. Won't we, Ma? It was Lawrence's impression that Mrs. Hubbard did not share his view. Lawrence discovered that very few passengers had read the German warning. He did not find this surprising. When you are getting ready to sail on a transatlantic liner at noon, he wrote, you seldom have time to sit down and peruse the morning papers. Even those who had seen the warning paid little attention. The idea that Germany would dare attempt to sink a fully loaded civilian passenger ship seemed beyond rational consideration. And even if a U-boat did try, common wisdom held that it would inevitably fail. The Lusitania was simply too big and too fast, and once in British waters would doubtless be too well protected by the British Navy. Only two passengers cancelled because of the warning itself, a wealthy shoe dealer from Boston named Edward B. Bowen and his wife. They did so at the last minute. A feeling grew upon me that something was going to happen to the Lusitania, Edward said later. I talked it over with Mrs. Bowen, and we decided to cancel our passage. although I had an important business engagement in London. A few others cancelled for reasons of illness and altered plans, or because they had resolved, warning aside, that sailing on a British ship in wartime wasn't prudent. The famed Shakespearean actress Ellen Terry planned initially to travel with producer Frohman on the Lusitania, but well before the warning appeared, she cancelled her booking and switched to an American ship, the New York. She encouraged Rita Jolivet to do likewise, but Jolivet kept her original booking. One of those who cancelled citing illness was Lady Cosmo Duff Gordon, a fashion designer who had survived the sinking of the Titanic. Another designer, Philip Mangone, cancelled for unspecified reasons. Years later, he would find himself aboard the airship Hindenburg on its fatal last flight. He survived, albeit badly burned. Otherwise, the Lusitania was heavily booked, especially in the lesser classes. Second class was so full that a number of passengers learned, to their delight, that they had been given first-class rooms. For those passengers who did feel unsettled by the German warning, Cunard offered comforting words. Wrote passenger Ambrose B. Cross, "From the very first, the ship's people asseverated that we ran no danger, that we should run right away from any submarine, or ram her, and so on, so that the idea came to be regarded as a mild joke for lunch and dinner tables." Moreover, a conviction existed among passengers that upon entering the waters off Britain's west coast, the so-called Western Approaches, the ship would be met by the Royal Navy and escorted to Liverpool. Cunard encouraged this belief, and may have believed it as well, on the basis of the Royal Navy's past efforts to direct and escort the company's ships. Long before the sailing, Oscar Grab, 28, a newly married clothing importer from New York, made an appointment to talk with a Cunard representative about submarines and the overall safety of transatlantic crossings. Grab's wife of 39 days had begged him to take an American ship. Grab and the Cunard official had a long talk, during which Grab was told that steps would be taken to protect the ship during the crossing. He felt reassured enough to buy a first-class ticket, although he waited to do so until the day before departure. Any passenger who read that morning's edition of the New York Times would have found explicit reassurance. In an article about the warning, the paper quoted Cunard's New York manager, Charles Sumner, as saying that in the danger zone, there is a general system of convoying British ships. The British Navy is responsible for all British ships, and especially for Cunarders. The Times reporter said, "Your speed, too, is a safeguard, is it not?" "Yes," Sumner replied. "As for submarines, I have no fear of them whatever." Passenger Ogden Hammond, a real estate developer and a member of the State Assembly of New Jersey, asked a Cunard official if it was safe to cross on the ship, and got the reply, "Perfectly safe. Safer than the trolley cars in New York City." A possibly ill-advised answer, given the high frequency of fatal trolley accidents in the city. Aboard the Lusitania, there was a good deal of gallows humor, but it was spoken from a position of comfort and confidence. "Of course, we heard rumors in New York that they were going to torpedo us, but we didn't believe it for one moment," said May Walker, one of the ship's stewardesses. "We just laughed it off and said they would never get us. We were too quick, too speedy. It was just the same kind of trip as it was any other trip." One of her tasks was to help manage passengers' children. There was all sorts of deck games, quoits, and they had fancy dress parades for them, Walker said. Children whose birthdays happened to fall during a voyage were given a party, a little private party, Walker said, and a birthday cake with their names on it. They had the time of their lives and the run of the ship. On this voyage, she would have her hands full. Many British families were now returning home to do their part in supporting the nation in time of war, and the ship's size and speed provided a degree of reassurance. The passenger manifest listed 95 children, and 39 infants. Whole families came aboard. Cunard set aside a group of first-class staterooms for Paul Crompton of Philadelphia and his wife and their 6 children, one infant included, and their nanny, 29-year-old Dorothy Allen. Cunard tickets did not identify babies by name, possibly out of quiet resentment that they traveled free. Crompton was a cousin of Cunard's chairman, Alfred Allen Booth, whose Booth Group owned the steamship line. Crompton headed the group's leather goods subsidiary. Cunard's New York manager, Sumner, greeted the family just before boarding and looked personally after their comfort for the voyage. On the opposite side of the ship, one deck down, the Pearl family of New York took 3 first-class staterooms, E-51, E-59, and E-67. Frederick Pearl was headed to London for a posting at the American Embassy and brought his wife and 4 children, a 5-year-old son, 2 daughters under the age of 3, and 1 infant. The Pearls brought along 2 nannies. The children, including the baby, stayed with their nannies in E-59 and E-67. The parents lounged in comparative bliss by themselves in E-51. Mrs. Pearl was pregnant. William S. Hodges, en route to Europe to take over management of the Paris office of the Baldwin Locomotive Works, was traveling with his wife and 2 young sons. When a Times reporter on the wharf asked Mrs. Hodges if she was afraid of making the trip, she merely laughed and said, "If we go down, we'll all go down together." There were parents sailing to rejoin their children, and children to rejoin their parents, and wives and fathers hoping to get back to their own families, as was the case with Mrs. Arthur Luck of Worcester, Massachusetts, traveling with her 2 sons, Kenneth Luck and Elbridge Luck, ages 8 and 9, to rejoin her husband, a mining engineer who awaited them in England. Why, in the midst of great events, there always seems to be a family so misnamed, is one of the imponderables of history. Among the less well-known but still prominent passengers who came aboard Saturday morning was a 48-year-old woman from Farmington, Connecticut, by the name of Theodate Pope, Theo to her friends. She was accompanied by her mother, who came to see her off, and by a man 20 years her junior, Edwin Friend, with whom she was traveling to London. Prone to wearing a velvet turban, Theodate was an imposing figure, though she stood only a little over 5 feet tall. She had blonde hair, a blunt chin, and vivid blue eyes. Her gaze was frank and direct, reflecting the independence that she had shown throughout her life and that had caused her to reject the path expected of women raised in high society. Her mother once scolded, "You never act as other girls do." Her contemporaries referred to her by that newly coined descriptive label, feminist. Theodate counted among her friends the painter Mary Cassatt, William James, and his brother, author Henry James, with whom she developed a particularly close friendship, to the point where she named a new puppy after him, Jim Jam. She was one of America's few female architects of stature, designer of a revered house in Farmington, which she named Hillstead. When Henry James first saw the house, even before he came to know Theodate, he crafted one of the more novel analogies of architectural criticism, likening the joy he felt to the momentary effect of a large slippery sweet inserted, without a warning, between the compressed lips of half-conscious inanition. Theodate had a competing passion, however. She was a spiritualist and served from time to time as an investigator of paranormal phenomena. Belief in such things was widespread in America and Britain at the start of the 20th century, when a Ouija board was a regular fixture in drawing rooms to be brought out after dinner for impromptu seances. With the advent of war, belief in an afterlife was poised for a resurgence, as Britons sought comfort in the idea that their dead sons might still be present in some way, somewhere in the ether. It was Theodate's interest in psychical research that explained why she and Edwin Friend were sailing to London. As the sole child of a wealthy Cleveland couple, she had spent her early life mostly alone. Her father, Alfred, was an iron tycoon. Her mother, Ada, a social